Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, board member for Pardes. In this special shiur for Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses the meanings and symbolism of the shofar. This is the second podcast for this week. Depending on how often you connect to the computer and download, you may need to manually download this week's first episode. In iTunes, click on Podcasts. Then open the Pardes from Jerusalem listing. If the previous episode is in gray, then you can press the button labeled Get to download it. On behalf of Pardes, Shana Tova, a sweet new year filled with happiness, good health, meaning, blessings, and peace for Israel, our people, and humanity. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Today I would like to examine some themes connected with the blowing of the shofar. If you hear any sirens in the background or any noise, this is not orchestrated. Those are the sounds of Jerusalem. When we look at the verses in the Torah, in chapter 23 of Leviticus, 23-24, and chapter 29, verse 1, in the book of Numbers, we see that the Torah tells us about the sound which is to be made on Rosh Hashanah, namely a truah. There is no mention whatsoever as to what type of instrument we should use. And in fact, in the Talmud, in Rosh Hashanah, page 33b, the Gemara brings a brayta, material from the time of the Mishnah, which says, what is our source text that we use a shofar? And interestingly, the text which is brought is a verse which speaks about blowing shofar on Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year, where it explicitly says in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 9, and you shall sound the shofar of the truah. And the rabbis make an analogy between the blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur, the Jubilee year, and between the sound of truah, which is made on Rosh Hashanah, and they say that all blowings which are done in the seventh month should be done with a shofar. But later on in the Talmudic discussion, the rabbis raise a question, which is, perhaps we should not use a shofar, but in fact, we should use a trumpet. As we see in the book of Numbers in chapter 10, that trumpets were used when the Jews were traveling in the desert to gather the people. And later on in that section, it speaks about blowing trumpets on festive occasions. It speaks of blowing trumpets during moments of crisis. And then the Talmud brings a second source text, which is from the book of Psalms, chapter 81, verse 4, which says, Tik'u vashchodesh shofar bakese liyom chagenu, which is understood to be sound on the new month, the shofar, at the hidden moment on the day of our celebration. And the rabbis say, which holiday do we celebrate where the new moon is covered up? That is the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is the only holiday which we celebrate on the new moon. And because it mentions sounding a shofar, we learn from this that the instrument used is a shofar. It is very interesting that the Torah does not explicitly mention the instrument. The focus in the Torah is the sound, a trua. And in fact, in that Talmudic discussion, on page 33b, 34a, the Talmud actually says, based on derivations from the blowing on the Jubilee year, that every time that you blow a truah, it is always surrounded by a tkiyah beforehand, a tkiyah afterwards. A tkiyah is the unbroken sound that we have. A truah is a broken sound. A tkiyah is a triumphal sound. A truah is a sound of crisis, of wailing. It is very interesting that in Rosh Hashanah, the sound is the truah, the sound of wailing, or one might say of crisis. And in fact, in that section which I mentioned earlier in the book of Numbers, which speaks about the trumpets, we're told that on festive occasions, on days of rejoicing, utkatem b'chatzotzrot, you shall blow the trumpets, but the sound is utkatem, which is a tkiyah. And we are also told that when there is a crisis, when there is war, when an enemy comes and distresses you, v'harei otem b'chatzotzrot, not a tkiyah, but a truah. So that if we look at these verses from the trumpets, it seems to be that tkiyah is associated with days of rejoicing. Truah is associated with days of crisis, warfare, pain, which then would lead us to conclude that Rosh Hashanah, in fact, is a day of crisis. The rabbis, both in the Mishnah and in Midrashic literature, refer to Rosh Hashanah as being the day of judgment. In the Torah itself, we are not told why we celebrate Rosh Hashanah, why we should make this sound. It's only in rabbinic literature that the rabbis develop the theme of it being the day of judgment. In fact, in a number of places in the Midrash, which found its way in the liturgy, the rabbis say that Rosh Hashanah commemorates the day of creation, but perhaps more specifically, the day in which human beings were created, the very same day that they were created, where they sinned and where they were judged. And on that basis, the rabbis say that Rosh Hashanah was established to be a day of judgment. So so that when the shofar is sounded, it is an alarm. It is a foreshadowing. God is now sitting in judgment. It is a call to awe and trembling. Interestingly enough, I mentioned earlier, whenever there is a truah, it is always couched with a tkiah before and a tkiah afterwards. We find in the book of Nehemiah, in chapter 8, that there was a public reading of the Torah, which was done on Rosh Hashanah. And when the Torah is read, all of a sudden the people are weeping, crying. One could say that the people really got the message of Rosh Hashanah. The public reading led to this sense of crisis, trepidation. And yet what we find is that the people are told, stop crying. Go and eat. Lechu ishmu ichlu mashmanim shtu mamtakim ki chedvat Hashem hima'uschem. Go and eat and drink, because the joy of the Lord is your strength. Because this day is a holy day to God. And on the basis of this verse, there is a law that we find that it is prohibited to fast on Rosh Hashanah. We're obligated to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, to eat and to drink. Nachmanides, in his commentary on the verse in Leviticus, which is the first source that we have for Rosh Hashanah, in chapter 23, verse 24, refers to Rosh Hashanah as being a Yom Din Berachamim. And interestingly, Yom Kippur is a Yom Rachamim Bedin. What is Nachmanides saying here? If we look externally at Rosh Hashanah, we get the picture which we find in the book of Nehemiah. Rosh Hashanah is supposed to be a day of celebration. It is supposed to be a day where we dress up nicely, where we eat, where we drink. The atmosphere, the mood that's created externally is a day of rachamim, of compassion, a day where we are being brought into relationship with God. But if we look at the core, the heart of Rosh Hashanah, it is a day of crisis, a day of soul searching. Nachmanides, in the Mishnah Torah, in the section which speaks about tshuva, in chapter 3, Halacha 4, says that although the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a decree of the text, which is another way of saying we don't really know the reason why we do it, but there is a hint as to why we do it. Namely, wake up, you sleepy people, from your slumber. Go out. Search your actions. Return to God in repentance. Remember your Creator. And then Maimonides says, this is a reference to those who forget the truth and the vanities of the moment, who spend their whole time in vanities and worthless pursuits, which will not bring them any purpose, any gain. Look at your souls, look at your paths, look at your actions, and may everyone leave his evil path and his thoughts, which are not good. Which therefore means that the blowing of the shofar is supposed to be an alarm, a shock, to get us out of our regimen, our routine. Perhaps a routine which is very prosaic, a routine where we're involved with all kinds of things which are vain and empty, which lead us nowhere. It's a call to begin to get us to think about what is really important in life. It is a call to make us realize this is the day of judgment. To look at ourselves, how do we now stand before God? So if I go back to what I mentioned earlier, when Nachmanides says this is a day of judgment, with compassion, Nachmanides is saying that the core of Rosh Hashanah is judgment. In my heart of hearts, when I hear that shofar, I should be trembling and shaking. I should be crying. I should look at myself and I should say to myself, what did I do this year? What did I accomplish? How much of my time was wasted? But as we find in the book of Nehemiah, Rosh Hashanah is not just a Yom Din, but a Yom Rachamim. God judges us in compassion. When we come before God in judgment, we dress up, we're festive, we eat nice meals. Because there's also the feeling that ultimately God will exercise compassion. There's the feeling that ultimately God is interested in having me change, would like to give me another chance. And this is the tension, the dialectic, which one has to experience on Rosh Hashanah. We go about acting as if this is a festive occasion. But in our heart of hearts, we feel a sense of terror, of crisis. Rosh Hashanah sets in motion a process, a period, which culminates in Yom Kippur. And very interestingly, Yom Kippur is the inverse of Rosh Hashanah. Nachmanides calls it Yom Rachamim Bedin. When we look at how we behave externally, we don't eat, we don't drink. We are prohibited from having sexual relations. We're not allowed to bathe. We're not allowed to wear shoes. There is what is known as the five inuyim, the five afflictions that we have to subjugate ourselves to. On Yom Kippur, we spend our whole day in the Beit Knesset. We confess. We cry. So that when you look at the externals, it seems to be that that sense of trembling, that sense of crisis, is what Yom Kippur is all about. But in fact, at its core, Yom Kippur is a Yom Rachamim. And similarly, in our heart of hearts, the feeling, the mood, God will forgive us. We may act as if the whole world is falling apart, but the feeling is, in the end, God is compassionate. God will give us another chance. So that there is this movement from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. On Rosh Hashanah, the externals are joyous. Internally, we are in turmoil. On Yom Kippur, externally, it seems that we're in turmoil. But internally, we are at peace with ourselves. We have a sense that in the end, yes, we will get a new page. I would just insert now, interestingly, what follows Yom Kippur is the holiday of Sukkot. And on Sukkot, there is no disconnect between the external and the internal. Sukkot is the holiday of pure celebration, of pure joy, both externally and internally. I celebrate. I am at peace with myself. Let me examine one more theme in terms of the shofar itself, the instrument that I use. As I mentioned earlier, the Torah is not explicit as to the instrument. And yet we find extensive discussions in rabbinic literature about the details of the instrument. And this appears in the Mishnah in the third chapter of Rosh Hashanah. And let me just take a few points which come up in the Mishnah. In the third chapter in Mishnah 2, there is a discussion as to what shofar can we use on Rosh Hashanah. The first opinion says all shofars are kosher, except that of a cow. The second opinion, Rabbi Yossi, says all shofars are kosher, including that of a cow. And the problem which seems to come up in the Mishnah is that the shofar of a cow is a keren, a horn. A horn rather than a shofar. And Rabbi Yossi responds by saying, but you know what? All shofarot are called keren, a horn. And he in fact brings a proof text from the book of Joshua, when the Jews are circling the city of Jericho and sounding the shofar. In the same verse, it refers to that instrument both as a keren, a horn, and a shofar. And to quote Shakespeare, what's in a name? What difference does it make what it's called? And why should it matter whether this is a shofar or a horn? There is an interesting comment which is made by Tosafot, a school founded by grandchildren of Rashi in the 1100s in Germany, which says that there are other horns which are also unacceptable. the horns of a Re'em. Which are certainly referred to as horns. So why didn't the Mishnah mention those? And the suggestion which he offers is that perhaps they are not hollow, and as a result, not fit for a shofar. And this seems to be a basic differentiation which separates horns from shofar. Horns are a solid bone. In order to make it into a blowing instrument, you have to drill, you have to chisel it out. A shofar is inherently hollow. In fact, the shofarot are external shells that in some cases actually screw on to a bone so that when you detach it from the animal, you simply have to screw it off and you're left with this hollow instrument. A cow's horn physically is a shofar. The problem is conceptually, linguistically, but we call it a horn. Why is this problematic? Based on a discussion which we find in the Talmud, in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, on page 26a, 26b, there seems to be a rabbinic understanding that the shofar symbolizes the person. The shofar is me. The shofar is me, who now stands before God, who is petitioning God, who's pleading with God. The sounds that I make are a petition. Parenthetically, I will say, if we look at what we mentioned earlier in Maimonides, the shofar can also be God speaking to us. A wake-up call. And a basis for this, by the way, is the revelation at Sinai, when the sounding of the shofar is introductory to the words of God, the Ten Commandments. But right now, I would like to focus on the aspect of the shofar being we, who are now praying to God. The shofar is me. The question is, how do I now present myself before God? And what seems to be, from the Mishnah, and by extension, from Tosfot, is that a horn is not the image that I want to present before God. Why? Well, in the Talmud, they refer to a verse from the book of Deuteronomy when Moses is blessing the tribes in chapter 34 of Deuteronomy. And in the blessing of Joseph, he refers to Joseph as Bechor Shoro. Joseph is the firstborn. Excuse me, this is chapter 33, verse 17. Not 34, 33. Bechor Shoro Hadarlo. He is the firstborn, an ox. Majesty is his. Bekarnei Re'em, and the horns of a Re'em, Karnav, are his horns. And the end of the verse is, Bahem Yinagach Amim. With them he will gore the nations. Ad Afse Aretz. To the ends of the earth. The horns are a symbol of majesty. The horns are a symbol of perhaps aggression, of an attack. Later on in the Tanakh, and certainly in rabbinic literature, we find how the horn is associated with the kingdom of David. We do not use a horn on Rosh Hashanah because when I come before God on this day of judgment, I do not come before God in majesty. Rather, I should come before God in profound humility. As we mentioned earlier, this is the day of judgment. Who can come before God and say, "You owe it to me. I was perfect. I am majestic. I must be inscribed in the book of life"? No one can do that. Rather, the way that we come before God is in profound humility, perhaps in a sense of shame, perhaps with a sense of tremendous trepidation. We are hollow men, to quote T.S. Eliot. We use a hollow instrument. We recognize our failures, our frailties. In fact, I would add, shofar would seem to be related to the Hebrew word shfoferet, which means a tube. And in Hasidic literature, they relate it to another word in Hebrew, which is shipur, improvement. Perhaps to improve, you need to be hollow. You need to recognize that you're not so solid, that in fact, you're fragile. You could easily fall apart. The more that a person recognizes their limitations, their failures, the better they are to improve their behavior. And therefore, we must use a shofar. That's how we are supposed to present ourselves before God. In that section of the Talmud, on page 26a, one explanation which is given for why the shofar of a cow is disqualified by the first opinion in the Mishnah is because the cow's horn reminds us of the golden calf. It echoes the golden calf. And on Rosh Hashanah, when we blow the shofar as a way of reminding God to be compassionate on us, as a way of trying to invoke all of our merits, in the language of the Talmud, the prosecutor cannot become the defense. I cannot defend myself using the instrument which invokes my sins. And therefore, use an instrument that conjures up only positive things, but does not bring up the memories of the golden calf. And if I follow the line of reasoning which I mentioned earlier, the golden calf was a situation where the Jewish people felt that Moses had left them. They were in crisis. And the way that they dealt with it was not to pray to God, was not to go to Aaron and ask him to approach God and find out what was going on. to present a solution. The way that they dealt with it was to assert themselves and to dictate to Aaron, let us make a God who will lead us. In certain ways, the golden calf is an example of people who assert their power, impose their power, want to be empowered. And in a situation of crisis, perhaps have illusory power rather than acknowledging their vulnerability and turning to the source that can help overcome it. So that on Rosh Hashanah, we should not feel empowered to the point where we come before God in majesty and dictate our terms. But in chapter 3, in Mishnah 6, we're told of another aspect, which is a shofar which is cracked, that was glued together, is disqualified. A broken shofar is unacceptable. And by the same token, a broken person is also not what we want to present before God. With all the sense of vulnerability and fragility, we should never come to the point where we are broken. Because once you're broken, it's very difficult to repair. Very difficult to fully repair. And therefore, there is this very delicate balance between, on the one hand, not going to the extreme of being empowered, feeling that I'm perfect, I am majestic. There's no place for criticism, self-criticism. But on the other hand, I can also not go to the extreme of feeling totally broken, worthless, feeling despair. I have to be critical, but I also have to be hopeful. I have to appreciate the trembling, the crisis, but also see the hope, the joy. Yom Din Berachamim, Truah, which is couched in Tkiah. It is a very, very delicate balance which has to be preserved. As we say, immediately after the sounding of the shofar, before we do the Musaf service, Ashrei Ha'am Yod'ei Truah. Fortunate, happy is the people who know the Truah. May we be able to know the Truah, to know how to tremble, to know how to be in awe, to be able to be self-critical, to look at ourselves, and to acknowledge our faults. But at the same time, may we be able to have that hope, that vision, that joy, that says that God is a God of compassion. God is a God of life, who wants life, who gives us a new lease on life. And with that sense of trembling and rejoicing, may we all merit to have a good year. May we all be inscribed in the Book of Life May we all, in the words of the Rambam, remember the truth. Remember what ultimately our purpose is in life and seek it out. If each one of us can improve in even the smallest way, then maybe we can create a reality which is more intact, which is more whole, which in the end can further the life of all of us. Shana Tova.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email via podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.